Hello, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to the very first episode of Cinema Recall here at thatmomentin.com. I am your host, The Vern, and I am extremely, extremely happy to have you here for our first episode of this podcast. And it seems fitting that my first guest is the owner, the creme de la creme, the owner of thatmomentin.com. We have with us David Dupre. Hello, David.
Hey, Vern, how are you? Thanks for having me on the first episode.
Hey, I'm very excited that I'm being a host for the show on your site. Extremely happy. I cannot wait to get into these movies right here. Yes, folks, the initial concept of this show is we are going to be taking a look at crucial moments in movies. Not just the whole movie itself, but crucial scenes in each movie. And you get to vote on what movie gets discussed. Over on the site, thatmomentin.com, we'll post a poll of five or so movies that we want to talk about, and you can choose which movie that is. And we'll have different themes like best gangster movies or best sci-fi movies. Just be different genres. We might do one with like different directors or actors. You can choose which movie we'll talk about, and then being a guest, we'll decide which scene we talk about then.
It's a great concept, and you know, it fits really well with the theme of the site. The site is thatmomentin.com, and the whole point of the site is that every movie has one great moment. So I think, Vern, this is going to be a great concept for a podcast.
Yeah. And for our first show, we decided to choose what is the best summer movie blockbuster, and I believe our choices were The Dark Knight, Jurassic Park, Men in Black, Avengers, and Back to the Future. It was actually a three-way tie.
Three-way tie, yeah. Everyone wanted us to cover all the movies.
Yeah. Couldn't just do that there. But our choice ended up being Back to the Future. Now, I don't know about you, David, here, but Back to the Future was probably my first summer blockbuster I saw in theaters.
Really?
That I can remember right there, actually going with my family to see it. That movie, I remember specifically, I remember the theater, I remember the lobby area, I remember how huge that movie was when you walked into, you know, the aisles right there. It was like just jam-packed of people.
Yeah, I remember too. Back to the Future is just a fantastic theater experience. I saw it in the theaters as well, and it's, you know, it's, we'll get into the filmmakers as well, but it is just a great experience.
Well, they did like release it back like not too long ago. For like their anniversary edition. That's when I saw it again that time. But I do know this is a movie that really had a hard time getting made. I believe that was like Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis. They tried to pitch out to different studios. And a lot of studios thought it was too light. Well, during that time, a lot of like 80s sets comedies were very popular. So a lot of other studios thought it was like too light. So they brought it to Disney, but Disney didn't like the idea. I guess Marty's mom seducing him.
Right.
So they didn't like that aspect of it. So they thought it was a little bit too much for a Disney label. And it wasn't until after Zemeckis made Romancing the Stone that it was able to get made by Amblin and Universal Studios. So,
and Romancing the Stone itself is a great movie I recommend as well. Yeah, you read about so many great stories about the making of or the production of this movie of especially, you know, things like what the time machine would eventually become and things like that. The story of Back to the Future is almost as exciting as the movie itself.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's do this right now, if you don't mind. Let's take a small break right now. We'll play some ads from some other great podcast shows, and then we will get back and talk about the crucial scene in Back to the Future, which I'll tell you right now is going to be the scene when George McFly finally stands up for himself.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you like movie podcasts hosted by inebriated people? That's Kai with the cracking voice and Heather's touched by evil. One thinks he's Spider-Man, the other is a ninja. It's the Man I Love Film Podcast, it's the Milkcast.
Hey everybody, everybody. I'm Kai.
And I'm Heather.
And we are the hosts of MILFcast, the Men I Love Films podcast, the unofficial official podcast of menilovefilms.com. This is the podcast where we like to talk about what we've been watching, talk about movies, but mainly we just like to drink, be silly, and play a whole bunch of games. So we think every other week you should grab a drink, snuggle up, and let us make sweet love to your ears.
Otherwise, we'll make sweet love to your couch.
So come and find us on iTunes. Just search for MILFcast.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Hey, you, get your damn hands off.
Oh, I think you got the wrong car, McFly.
George, help me, please.
Just turn around, McFly, and walk away. Are you deaf, McFly? Close the door and beat it.
No, Biff. You leave her alone.
All right, McFly. And we are back. Welcome back, everyone, to Cinema Recall. I'm here, the Vern, with our special guest, David Dupre. So I'm sure everyone here has seen Back to the Future, but for some reason you're listening to this podcast, you've never seen Back to the Future before, let's actually do a small little recap about how we got to this particular scene, okay? So, Marty McFly is this guy who lives in 1985. His mother is this prude who says she's never kissed a boy before, and his father gets picked on and walked over a lot. One night, while visiting his friend, he is sent back to the year 1955. And this time, he sees his parents as exactly the same age as he is. But one crucial event gets altered, and his parents don't end up meeting and falling in love. So now, Marty's mom has got the hots for him, which is very odd here. And Marty and George, Marty's dad, they devised this plan how George is going to become like the big hero, you know, because Marty's going to take his mom to the prom, which rhymes in a weird way, and he's going to pretend to attack her, and George is going to show up. Well, it doesn't work out that way because Biff Tannen, who has been this bully for the whole time, he actually ends up locking Marty in a trunk. And so now when George goes to the car, he thinks that, you know, it's going to be, you know, Marty there, and it's not. No, now, one not thing all. I do want to talk briefly before we get to that moment here, David, is the moment with Marty and his mom when they actually drive to the prom.
Yeah, I think it's important to talk about that.
Because there is, like, a lot of good juxtaposition of the characters. Like, Marty himself is nervous having to go through this act with his mom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Lorraine, played wonderfully by Leah Thompson,
sure.
She sees that he's nervous, but she thinks that he's nervous because, you know, they're teens, they like each other, they don't know how to express their feelings.
Do you mind if we park for a while?
It's a great idea. I'd love to park.
Huh.
Marty, I'm almost 18 years old. It's not like I've never parked before.
What?
Marty, you seem so nervous. Is something wrong?
No. Lorraine, what are you doing?
I swiped it from the old lady's liquor cabinet.
Yeah, well, you shouldn't drink.
Why not?
Because you might regret it later in life.
Marty, don't be such a square. Everybody who's anybody drinks.
You smoke too?
part of your beginning sound, just like my mother.
This is a really crucial moment because we've got Marty, who knows that this is his mother, but we've got Lorraine, who does not know that this is actually her son in the future. And you know, like you said at the start of the podcast, that Disney was very nervous about this moment. And, you know, it's a really delicate moment, but it's handled very well. And you know, the thing is, they let things happen organically so that they actually, you know, for her especially, she's got to experiment. She's got to find out if this Calvin Klein guy really is you know, the love of her life. And she, when they do actually kiss, which sounds really strange when you just talk about it, but as it happens, it feels right. And I think that was the best way to reveal that there is something there that should not connect them, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just like the fact that it's a very kind of like a very funny, heartwarming scene, but it never becomes uncomfortable. All right,
like, no.
You can totally understand. Well, even before the events there too, you can totally understand that, you know, Marty's one that got hit by a car, and, you know, she sees his underwear, calls him Calvin Klein all the time. And,
right,
you know,
yeah.
Because she's just, you know, a simple teenage girl, and I like the fact in that scene when she drinks, and he's just totally shocked by it, like, Mom, you drink? and she starts lighting up a cigarette, like, Mom, you smoke too? Because we never actually picture our parents as being young, all right?
Or that's a good point.
Having those types of like feelings. I do know, I was looking up research for this film, that I think it was Robert Zemeckis. He found out that his mother always said that, you know, she never kissed a boy, but it turns out that she was actually very promiscuous in her young age. So moving on from, you know, that moment with Marty and his mom in the car, and he gets taken by Biff. Biff, and I'm blanking on that. Thomas something here.
Thomas Wilson.
Thomas Wilson, thank you. All right. He takes Marty, locks him in the trunk of the car. The band, basically.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Marvin Berry.
Marvin Berry, gosh, yes. Chuck Berry. Marvin Berry, Chuck Berry's band. So he's locked in the car. George, on cue, is run up to the car. He opens the door, and he says, "Hey, man, take your damn hands off of her." And then the guy turns around, and it's Biff. And this has been a guy who has been, like, picking on George the whole time. And Lorraine is... Now, I have to ask you this, all right? I find it kind of odd and strange that essentially Marty's plan was to date rape his mom.
Yeah, here's where we're walking on some really thin ice. And
yeah,
there's a really big tonal shift in the film. And I wrote about this a while ago on the website where the plan, of course, is to have the appearance of a date rape without ever actually saying that, because he's supposed to come and save the day. You know, George is supposed to come and save the day before that happens. But what we really have is an actual date rape. And it's a jarring moment because, as you said, Biff has been a buffoon. He's been the villain, but he's been a comic villain.
Yep.
And now suddenly here he is in this car. He's had a change, and he's going to take advantage of this girl. And it shocks even his little henchmen. They even get a little, they cut to them, and their faces are a little bit shocked. And he's like, well, you know, he tells them to get out of here. And we get a startling moment where if George doesn't show up, then Lorraine is in serious trouble. I don't know about you, but when I first saw it, I was even a little shocked by it.
I was too. I mean, everything was very kind of light and serious, very light and playful, even during the big, like, skateboard chases and everything. Like, but we do get this one moment here where, yes, if George doesn't do something, Lorraine is going to be seriously hurt. And even though this is, like, a family picture, you can still feel the tension. I mean, she still could get attacked, even though they don't actually show it, though. And that would just be a very different movie if it happened with her. So,
well, I don't want to cut you off, but it completely redefines who Biff Tannen is. And the movie essentially glosses over that because it needs to get back to the comedy. It needs to do that. And then in other subsequent films that follow, he becomes, again, the buffoon. But this few minutes really redefines who Biff is. And thankfully, it really isn't brought to our attention again. But it's really important, Vern, that he does this, because this is why this is that moment in the movie. This is when we have the hero. This is when George steps up. And without this moment, without Biff becoming as cruel and degenerate as he is, we might not have the same like heroic feeling we have for George that he comes up with when he does take out Biff.
Yeah, it would seem kind of passé and sort of lame if it was just a standard, hey, I'm picking on you, George, and George punches him out.
Right.
It's very important that you put Lorraine in the situation so that George has something to fight other than himself.
And what's the second thing that's really important about this is that Marty is not here. You know, Marty has been the catalyst for all of this. He's been the one setting up all, you know, that's been the comedy, is him, you know, spinning the plates and juggling the balls and trying to keep it all in the air, trying to get everyone in the right position at the right time. And of course, that plan completely crumbles. And I think a lot of people overlook the fact that what's really, really essential about this moment is that Marty is completely absent. As you said, he's been carried off and he's been put in the trunk of Marvin Berry's car. He's not even here. And so that doubles down on George being the hero. He is the hero, and he becomes the savior for Lorraine. And, you know, I've always found that really odd, jumping ahead a little bit, because at the very end of the film, the parents, Lorraine and George, give credit to this guy they met in high school as, you know, the one who brought them together. And I guess that's kind of true, but when you really pick apart the film, it's not really what happens, because Marty is absent in this moment, and it is Lorraine that sees George as the hero. And, you know, my favorite moment in the movie is after the hit is done and Biff is knocked out, and George just looks down to Lorraine and offers his hand, and he just says, "Are you okay?" with this, you know, this changing voice that you can hear. In a very important moment before this, we learned about how he wants to be her destiny, right? Her density. Yes. He says it first, you know, "I want to be your density, but I want to be your destiny." And then he becomes this right in front of our eyes. And there's this, and you know, we want to talk about the direction a little bit later on, maybe, but Robert Zemeckis is an amazing director. And the way he puts his camera in this scene where we are POV of Lorraine looking up, and we get this really magical hero shot of George bending down and leaning his hand down to pick her up and asking her, "Are you okay?" It gives me shivers. It's a fantastic cinematic moment.
Yeah, very much so. And I just watched that scene again not too long ago. And yeah, you're right, when the camera looks down at Lorraine, and I gotta give credit where due to the actors, because there's like this glimmer in Leah Thompson's eyes,
mm-hmm.
where we can actually see how she is feeling towards George. And also, I give credit to where credit's due to Crispin Glover, who was basically this buffoon guy. I mean, well, I wouldn't say buffoon, but it's, you know, nerdy, shy guy right there. And that moment when he actually does knock Biff out, just that anger and look in his face when Biff is holding his arms behind his back. And you think, when I'm watching that scene, I remember clearly when I'm watching that scene in theaters, I'm like, oh shit, George is gonna get knocked out. I really thought that George is gonna get knocked out and Marty's gonna come in there and attack Biff. And I thought it was gonna do like a really cliche way and have Marty attack Biff, but somehow George and Lorraine would still end up falling in love with each other.
Right.
And I'm so glad that Marty just gets to the scene right after Biff gets knocked out. And I also like the fact, too, that we are focused more on George and Lorraine moment this moment than just seeing Mars' reactions, just seeing his parents there. Because this is crucially their moment with each other. And
it really is.
Yeah, just such a beautiful moment right there. Don't know what to
say. Well, you know, I'm gonna continue on with that thought because, you know, the movie really is obviously about Marty and his arc. But if you want to talk about character arc, it's really this movie is about George McFly. This is his story, and he ends up in the peripheral because Michael J. Fox is such a charismatic actor, and Christopher Lloyd as Doc Brown are just so they're such a great comedy team. But this story is really about George McFly, and
because Marty's main goal is just to get back home, and also to get his parents back together. I mean, Marty basically sets up the moment right there, but it's really up to George to follow through. So they have this plan where it's going to be Marty. And it's great that it is actually is Biff, because Biff has been like this tormentor and this villain his whole life. And the fact that he does actually stand up to him is just really crucial.
And I want to bring this up as a, I guess as a theory. And I like your opinion on Vern because you're good at this. But in this timeline, this is the timeline that Marty's he's basically altering time, and he's now trying to get his parents back together. In the real timeline that he has before this, where his parents are, George is still nerdy and he's still under the thumb of Biff. Did this incident in the car at the dance actually happen with Biff and Lorraine without Marty or George? Did that really happen?
That's an interesting part right there, because earlier we find out that Lorraine, we found out that George got hit by Lorraine's dad, and Lorraine felt sorry for him, and that's how they started dating. But yeah, I mean, Biff, I'm sure, was always still tormenting Lorraine and George. So that is very fascinating, though. I really don't know for sure.
We can't know, right?
I have this feeling, too, that I don't think they drove to the prom together. I thought maybe they went their separate ways. And they showed up there at the prom. But I'm sorry, it was under the Enchantment Sea Dance.
And under the Enchantment Sea Dance, right.
My apologies.
That's okay.
I'm sure they actually were there at the dance, and I think it was just her just feeling sorry for the guy, and just that was it. She just felt sorry for the guy. Being the fact that I'm pretty sure that Lorraine was probably promiscuous and probably have seen other guys, and then she realized, like, well, George is a nice and stable enough guy. I'll marry him, because during that time, especially that period right there, most younger people just got married.
Yeah,
no, David, that's a very fascinating theory there. I'm hoping not. I'm hoping that she was never.
Oh, me too.
Attacked, okay. You know, but maybe that explains, her alcoholism a little bit.
It would explain a lot, right? It really would. And it's an interesting fan theory that I think maybe somebody can take a look at more deeply. But I've pondered it a few times, and I've just wondered because there are things that on both sides of the coin, like you just said, it would explain a lot about the behaviors of them as adults in the pre going back to the past. And also it might explain why Biff has such a control over George. I'm not sure, but either way, I want to get back to, Crispin Glover, because I know this, Vern, but maybe some listeners might not. But, Crispin Glover joined this movie for one reason, and he found out that the movie was going in a different direction as it was going. And I'm sure that he has publicly stated that he is not happy with how the ending of the movie came out, with the central message of the movie that prosperity and money will make you happy. I think that was one of the larger problems he's had with the film. And he's spoken about it on podcasts and such. And this moment, it also showcases a character that wins over this woman by saving her. And you know, I'm asking you, Vern, can you delineate between the two? Do you think there is a difference between the two?
Yeah, but that's you bring up a lot of good things right there. I find it kind of odd that his first book has become like this big seller. He's able to sell a book like right away.
Right.
We see him at the end of the movie there too. They're all like this big, successful people, and they're able to buy their son a new car and everything.
Yeah, right.
And they got the new clothes right there. I find that to be kind of fake. I do like the fact that Lorraine and George are very much more in love. They're a lot more sexually active with each other. I find that to be a true thing. I find it kind of odd that Biff is now working for his dad and
being
kind of the buffoon character there. I find that to be a little bit misplaced. In fact, I still don't understand why Biff is even in the timeline.
Right.
If that made sense there. Like, I don't understand. After George knocks him out, why is he still around those two?
All right. Yeah.
It made sense in somewhat the original timeline, you know, because George is such a pushover that I'm sure he would be working for someone like Biff.
Right.
That made sense. But now, after this new thing's been altered and George knocks him out, it feels odd that he's even in the picture.
You know? It is one of the weaker points of the first film, and it smacks of trying to extend the character, because the knockout should have been the knockout. We should not have heard from Biff again. That should have been the end of it. And it's obviously a narrative device to bring closure to the comedy of it, but also to reinstate him into it, so that there is a chance for the sequels, right? So I mean, that was just a writing choice. But as a standalone film, if you're gonna have Back to the Future be a standalone film, I really wish that he would not been in the timeline at the end. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, and getting back to what you said, you know, about Crispin Glover's problem with the way the movie went at the end. Yeah, I kind of do agree with it, because George's personality changes kind of drastically, if you think about it there. Like, he's not the kind of like lovable nerd, you know. He's like very much, and I'm sure this has to do with the culture that we were living in at the time. And George got this very much like a yuppie attitude. You know, he just seems like a completely different person. Especially though, Butzel's got the sunglasses there and everything. He's a little bit more hip and cool, and that wasn't the George we saw back in 1955 when he finally was able to stand up for himself. I mean, that was a very, very crucial moment for him, and I just don't really buy him just becoming this, you know, dealer type of, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. And character. These are the things that Crispin Glover fought against with Robert Zemeckis and the filmmakers, and it's what got him to be fired from the second film, and because he did not agree with what you're saying, this character arc, and the fact that he would be so changed, and that money would be the driving force behind their happiness. So all of those things are just, of course, simple narrative devices, again, that help bring closure to the story visually for the audience. But it's too bad, because up to that point, the movie is so well written, and it does seem like a flat ending to me. I agree with you.
Very much so. Well, I do want to talk a little bit. We talked a little about the actors right there. We didn't really mention much about Leah Thompson in this. Who I think has always been a fantastic actress, even if she's in bad movies like Howard the Duck.
Right, yeah.
She still is great.
Howard the Duck, right?
Exactly. And I thought her moments here were very real and genuine, especially the moments when, you know, when she is being attacked by Biff and she says, "George, help me, George." I felt so scared for her. And it doesn't matter how many times I watch this movie, I always tense up at that.
It's so authentic, right? We take for granted good actors. I think that's the real issue. Is we good actors are so good that they make it look easy, like you could do it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, at this level, at this caliber, it's something else to watch, because that scene is so authentic. You get a real sense of danger, and you're right. You feel it. You feel like, "Whoa, wait, what's happening? This is really changing suddenly. What's happening here?" And you know, Leah Thompson was fearless in that moment. I really think that, I mean, she is having to play the damsel, and there's a little bit of a tropish attitude about it, but it's essential. That's very essential for this couple, and she does a fantastic job. I can't say enough about her performance. It's really good. It's very playful, like you said, and it's very serious. I think it's very good.
Yeah, like the moment, too, when she's, like, in the car with Marty before the movie, as we mentioned before, just the reaction on her face after she kisses Marty, that look in her eyes when she just slowly bats up away, and she's like, "This is going to sound weird, but when I kissed you, it feels like I was kissing my brother."
And right, just right,
that,
right.
That slow reveal there, all right? I like the fact that Robert Zemeckis and even his editors able to just take that moment and just have her just slowly back away and just see that look on her face that, there's a connection there. I'm not quite sure.
All absolutely.
Right? Yeah, just brilliant, brilliant moment in that.
It really is. She sells it.
I think it's funny, too, that we spent this whole podcast talking about Back to the Future, but we really didn't talk much about Michael J. Fox's performance in this.
Well, he's not part of this moment. I say that, but he's actually he's part of it, right? He lingers around it. He's the one who sets it up. You've mentioned how he is part of that, the build up to that when he's in the car with his mother there. Yeah, what's to say? Michael J. Fox is he is Back to the Future. I don't think you could even picture anybody else in the role, right?
Well, you know, originally, like, Eric Stoltz was cast in the movie, and he did shoot, like, a bunch of footage with him.
Yeah.
And both, I think it was, like, Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale both said that Eric Stoltz is a very talented actor, but he's just taking this role a little bit too seriously. There's not enough comedic elements.
Yeah, it was going to go dark first, right? It was supposed to be a dark story, but then they wanted a comedy. And who else in the 80s is going to get but Michael J. Fox for that? He's perfectly cast.
Yeah, very much so. And even the awkwardness, that whole scene of him having to go to a prom with his mom and pretend to be a date, that's going to be awkward for anybody, okay?
Anybody,
even if it's to help get your parents back together again, that's going to feel really uncomfortable. And you can feel his uncomfortableness of having to be in the situation. And I love, you know, Leah Thompson, you know, being uncomfortable, but she's just kind of nervous because she's out with a cute boy and everything like that.
Mm-hmm. There is so much to unpack about Marty McFly that we could do a whole podcast on him. a high school student whose best friend is an aging scientist who lives alone with his dog, and there's just so many weird things about him, you know.
David, that's true. That is a very kind of weird thing to have this guy. And Marty McFly has always been like this cool guy too, you know. He's got a cute girlfriend, he's in a rock band, and he spends a lot of time hanging out with this very older dude. Yes.
It's very weird, right?
Very weird. It is. All right, I don't know. Is there anything else you want to say about, you know, this moment here? I think we kind of like covered everything.
Well, I just want to cue up some of the people who, some listeners who might be tempted to watch the film again. And I want them to, I mean, they probably, like you said before, anyone listening to this podcast has probably watched Back to the Future a few times, if not once. And I think it's well deserved to watch it again, but put your focus on George and realize this movie is about him, and pay close attention to that moment in the diner when he asks her, you know, that tells her that he's going to be her destiny. And then see how that builds up to this moment when he actually does become. It's really fantastic writing, and it's just great filmmaking.
You can even see when he's in that diner talking to Lorraine, the look on her eyes right there, like, oh, they have that moment of connection there.
It's a mirror,
Until, you know, Biff kind of shows up and ruins it, you know, and I think that when, you know, George sees Biff in the car with Lorraine, you know, he's got to, like, just man up and stand up to her, because he couldn't stand up to Biff at the diner, but he didn't. And so now it's like, now or never, all right? And that moment, when I watched it again in theaters, that is a moment where you couldn't even hear a pin drop in that scene.
It's true. And I really want to stress the importance of those two scenes and how they are a mirror of each other, from the bench seats, from the diner she's sitting on, the angle, the way that he's positioned. I'm talking about George, how he's positioned. They are mirrors of each other, and it's fantastic. It's what makes Back to the Future such a great movie.
Yes, I totally agree with that. Yeah. Just very iconic right there. I know we can probably end up maybe talking about the sequels to this right now, because there are a lot of great moments in that sequel, especially number two, where Marty is watching himself at the dance again. Because they do replay a lot of elements from the first Back to the Future.
It's so well done. It's so well done.
Yeah, very well done there. Well, I don't know. I think this kind of wrap up things right now. Especially for this episode of Cinema Recall. David Dupre, I want to say thank you so much for being on this very first episode, sort of leading the way here, since this is your site, and I'm very honored to. I do know if you want to actually be on an episode of this, I will definitely post tweets on Twitter. You can definitely follow everything that happens with us on Twitter. At That Moment In, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Video Vanguard. If you go to the site, thatmomentin.com, there will be a new poll posted, and we will give you, the listener, a chance to vote on 5 different movies. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the movie we'll be talking about. I'll be bringing on a new guest, and we'll be talking about a particular scene from that movie. But David, thank you again. You have brought in like a lot of elements about this movie that I never really thought about before. I never really thought too much about, you know, the ending of George McFly changing that much right there. You brought in like a lot of good feedback for this episode, and I greatly, greatly appreciate it so much, sir.
Well, I'm glad to be on the inaugural show, and I look forward to be on in a few more episodes as well.
Yes. So definitely check out more of our episodes on the site, thatmomentin.com. I am your host, DeVern, for this first episode. With Valerian and The City of 1,000 Planets opening up in theaters, we are going to have our next poll be about the movies of Luc Besson. And we're going to have you, the listeners, choose what Luc Besson movie we are going to be discussing. All right, and our 5 choices are La Femme Nikita, Leon, which is the international version of The Professional, not The Professional, mainly talking about Leon, alright? The Fifth Element, Lucy, and Angel A. In fact, I'm even going to put an option on there too. If you think there's a better movie that we should discuss from Luc Besson, go ahead and put it in the optional category. It has to be a movie that was directed by Luc Besson. It can't be written by Luc Besson, so I apologize, but Taken cannot be on there. Taken or The Transporter are not eligible. It has to be movies that was actually directed by Luc Besson. So again, the choices are La Femme Nikita, Leon, The Fifth Element, Lucy, Angel A, or optional. If the optional gets more votes, we'll talk about that as well. All right, Yep, again, thank you all for listening. If you want to hear more of our episodes, you can hear our episodes on Stitcher, iTunes. David, where else can we hear this episode?
That's going to be on Podomatic, and I'm going to post it on the website.
I'll post it on the website. Okay, good. All right, good. All right. But anyways, that's going to just wrap up things right now. I want to say thank you all for listening, and stay tuned for next show.